Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the show. This is School Sucks Podcast number 263. So a couple weeks back, I put a little thread on our My Facebook page asking for guest suggestions. Who do you want to hear on the show? I'll go track them down and reach out to them and apologize that the show has the word sucks in the title, and maybe they'll come on. So that's what happened today. We've got Anna Martin. And, you might also notice that a couple other suggestions in that thread, Keegan and Will both suggest Wes Bertrand. Sam says Thaddeus Russell would be terrific to have him back. You might have noticed we've got series going on with both of those people right now. So, wow, Brett, you're a real man of the people. Thanks for saying so. The truth is that both of those series were actually planned prior to the existence of that thread, but thanks for helping me prioritize a little bit. And I certainly also see why Anna was one of the suggestions. I look forward to an opportunity to work with her again in the future. And if you are brand new to School Sucks, please consider checking out our website at schoolsucksproject.com. You can make a user account, join groups, participate in forums, comb through our archives. They're quite extensive. They're organized by series, but you can also search by topics. And the topics include the trivium, productivity, the history of compulsory schooling, a variety of unschooling and home education topics, philosophy of liberty, peaceful parenting, communication, history, entrepreneurship, college versus uncollege, etc. It's also searchable by names. We've had a lot of the greats, including Tom Woods, Jeffrey Tucker, and Bob Murphy, if you're interested in economics. So once again, the website is schoolsucksproject.com, and let's get to the show. You're going to join our conversation a couple minutes into it, so let's do it. Have a good, what's today, Monday. Well, no, have a good week. Oh, Valentine's Day is this week. Happy Valentine's Day, all you little Valentines. Mm-hmm.
I've listened to a couple of your podcasts on the Trivium, and I've of course tuned in when Jeffrey Tucker is there because he's just my hero. So I've listened, I would say, a few times, but I see that you've got hundreds and hundreds of podcasts, and I thought there's no way I'm going to catch up. So
there is quite a lot of content there.
And we've got some overlap with the ideas on the war on kids and on John Taylor Gatto, and I really like everything that I'm seeing. So. Are you familiar with the libertarian homeschooler?
Well, I just put out a request to my audience and I said, who would you like me to have on the show? And your name came up. And it seems like the central part is the Facebook page.
Yes. I'm just beginning to migrate over to a blog. And my son, who is, he's managing my brand for me. He has set me up with Pinterest and Instagram, Twitter, all kinds of stuff that I don't yet know how to use.
But Tumblr,
he's the one that's really sort of, he's telling me you need to do more, you need a newsletter, you need this, you need that. So he's really managing the way that the libertarian homeschooler is going.
Well, it sounds like I could learn a few things from him. I'm still trying to figure out why I would use Tumblr or Pinterest.
Pinterest is good for homeschoolers because a lot of people learn really well through a good visual. And sometimes it's nice to be able to scan over a whole lot of stuff and say, that one makes sense to me, to my eyes. That's the way it comes in.
Yeah, I've used Pinterest for infographics, which can definitely be very helpful.
Right. There are a lot of homeschoolers that use Pinterest. It's not unusual to find really good stuff there.
Yeah. I've seen some really cool things there. It was just a question of how was I going to make it useful to my brand. And I really wanted to do Tumblr because it just looks fun and it should be more image oriented, but I just haven't figured it out yet.
Yeah. Oak says that Tumblr is more like Twitter.
Hmm.
It's like a blog
form. Except it's like a blog form of Twitter. I have no idea. This is all stuff that he's going to have to introduce me to and really get me up and running. So he's going to be learning how to get someone who is just completely IT free to being savvy, which is going to be a really big job for him.
Right.
When I started in 2009, it was just Facebook, and Facebook is still there. So despite some of its problems, it's been pretty reliable.
Right.
And you've built a pretty big following there, right?
Yeah, I've got, I'm closing in on about 45,000 readers, and they're interacting on the page. It's a big civil conversation about children, property rights, economics, homeschooling, parenting, the non-aggression principle. You know, we cover a lot. We cover a lot of ground. We're talking about, you know, Mises and, you know, the water diamond paradox one day, and then the next day we're talking about bedtime. So it's a very diverse group.
Well, that's very cool. Civil discussions on Facebook. Congratulations. You know, on-
we make that an aim to talk to one another constructively, because really when you're fussing and yelling and being ugly, what's the point? Why do it?
You're absolutely right, and I'm really encouraged by the number of people that you've attracted, because here we have these two countercultural forces. One is unpopular for some reasons, the other is unpopular for other reasons. Both seem to have this common thread of people not having enough information about them or not having thought enough about either libertarianism or homeschooling.
Right.
So you've joined them together and built a reliable following. So I think that's awesome.
Yeah, it's a diverse group, and they do know a lot about homeschooling. And, you know, we get the whole spectrum. I've got radical unschoolers to people who are duplicating school at home, but thinking maybe that's not the hottest idea. And then, you know, we've got utilitarians and deontologists, and they're being civil to one another. So it's a good conversation. I really like it when the economists show up.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So how many children do you have?
I have two. I have a 13-year-old boy and a 9-year-old boy.
And did they ever go to school?
No. I was a homeschooler before I had babies.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I like to over-prepare. So before I had my children, I had already started reading about homeschooling. It was an acquaintance. It wasn't even a friend. And I met her homeschooled children, and I thought, that's it. That's what I'm doing. And I wasn't married at the time, but I was going to stay home, and I was going to homeschool my children. So there were a lot of decisions made well in advance of having the two boys, and homeschooling was the big one. That was one of the things that I said to my husband on our first date. I said, listen, here's the deal. I'm going to homeschool any children that I have. If that's a problem, we should just we should make this a more platonic kind of thing. And I think he raised his eyebrows and he thought, well, I guess what you see is what you get. And he was cool with that. So that worked out well.
So it actually brings me to the first question I sent you when I was asking, you know, were you a libertarian who found homeschooling or a homeschooler who eventually discovered libertarianism? Sounds like homeschooling was there first.
Yes, homeschooling was there first. In fact, when I was younger and very idealistic and had very little understanding of economics, I was a liberal, because I was really against things like war, and I was really in favor of things like civil liberties. Mm-hmm. Because I didn't understand economics, I was a liberal. And that's strange, because my father's an economist, and you think, you know, why is an economist kid not understanding money? And then you think about it, and you go, oh, right, he's a Keynesian economist. No wonder she thought money grew on trees.
Right.
So, and then when I got married, I began to understand money. And then it was when my children arrived that I became a libertarian. And that is because I was going to have to explain some difficult things to them, and I was going to have to be consistent. And libertarianism is just about the only stance that is consistent. It's logical. It's based on economics and good political theory. That was where I had to go. I didn't have much of a choice.
Yeah. I have found, because I came from the left as well, and I found that being consistent on, I would say, probably the issue of utmost importance in civilization, which is freedom, but often overlooked, and people are kind of schooled to believe they're free enough, because, you know, after 15,000 hours of asking permission to speak and go to the bathroom. There's not much that isn't going to look like freedom after that, I always say. So, you know, most people think they're free enough. And the idea of liberty is really, unfortunately, in our society, and probably it's been the case in most societies, an afterthought, if it's an understood concept at all.
I don't think it is an understood concept. I think that it looks really dangerous. I think that as a real concept, as a true concept, I think liberty looks really scary to a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. So when you were getting into, you're a homeschooler, you've got very young children, you're discovering the philosophy of liberty, what were some of the resources or what had like a really big impact on you when you were learning?
I began watching Milton Friedman videos on YouTube. And I like to say that Milton Friedman was my gateway drug. And
sure.
Friedman led to Hayek, and Hayek led to Mises. And I was reading widely over at some other economics blogs. I was listening to Econ Talk, the Library of Liberty. I've got small children in the house when I'm doing this. So that was interesting. And I was also somewhat sleep deprived. But yeah. I just plugging along because I knew that they were going to be asking questions. I landed at the Ludwig von Mises Institute, and I started reading widely, and I started listening to lectures, and it really fed me at a very, very deep level, and things that I had not understood before became really clear. And it was during a time in the country's in a recent economic debacle when everything was really a low point. We hit that. In our personal history, we hit that economic low before everybody else did, because my husband, he works in construction. Mm-hmm. He sells systems to great big buildings. And so construction was all of a sudden down. And our economics were really pretty bad, and I really needed to find out why. And that's really what happened. I began with economics, and there was a lot of economics. And economics led to political theory. And so some good Austrian economics will always take you to classical liberal thought. So that's how I came into it. I love economics.
Absolutely. And it seems like you had a good running start with some concern about civil liberties.
Right.
And I remember that feeling of feeling pretty betrayed by the mainstream left when I realized they didn't actually stand for these things.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I was really anti-war. And when I was a teenager, I remember looking at a physical map of the world, not a political map. And I looked at it, and I was talking to a friend. I said, there aren't any lines on here. There aren't any boundaries. This entire boundary thing, this is arbitrary. This doesn't make any sense. Why? What is up with that? But I just kind of left that idea alone because it seemed at some point it seemed a little bit too radical and naive. But I've come back around to it. And ideas that I sort of had abandoned when I began to think about, okay, where's the money that belongs to this family? Where is it going? And I became kind of irritated with the left because it seemed like they were squandering our inheritance. And it felt like we were getting higher and higher and higher in debt. And then we've got conservatives doing the same thing. And I thought, they're exactly the same. This is actually not two sides of the same coin. This is actually the same side of the coin. It's just, it depends on if you're looking at it from the left or the right. They're the same people.
Yeah. So all of that makes sense so far as how you arrived at where you did. It's nice that people discover this, I guess, when either before they have kids or when their kids are very young. So how did the embrace of the philosophy of liberty inform or affect or help create the educational environment in your home?
Well, when you say the philosophy of liberty, what I'm thinking about is, in its most simple level, is that great little video on YouTube.
Mm.
And it's also, you know, the beginning of Jonathan Gullible,
yes.
The philosophy of liberty. And so my children have been watching that video since my 9-year-old was four. And he hears the music and he comes running because he likes to watch it. And it seems somewhat soothing to him, and he knows the words, he understands the concepts. But as I was thinking about those concepts, I thought, how is this playing out in my relationship with my children? Do they have property rights in our home? And I thought, no, you know what? They really don't have property rights in our home. It seems that it's all ours, and they're just borrowing it. And that's not going to help them figure out how to exercise property rights when they're out in the real world. Home is the place where you get to practice these things and make lots of mistakes, hopefully, with the ideas of liberty. And so for me, that is lapidary. That's what we teach before we teach anything. The philosophy of liberty, you can't begin with anything else until the child understands property rights, until they understand life, liberty, and property, until they understand encroachment. These come first. Just to live in a family environment, just so that people understand this belongs to your brother. So no, you may not snatch it out of his hands. That's property rights. And just to live in the house with other human beings, you have to understand the philosophy of liberty. At least that's what I think, because we really take it seriously around here. That's our bedrock, I suppose you could say.
Has there been difficulties at times, and were interventions necessary? Obviously, I'm thinking when kids are very young, this is hard for them to grasp.
Sure. And that has, for our family, that had more to do with really bad modeling on our part than it had to do with the sort of normal stages of development for a child. We modeled things like, oh, you need to share. Well, sharing is nothing but saying property rights don't exist. And so when you tell someone, oh, you need to share, what you're saying is you don't actually have property rights. And so we had sort of laid that down for a while. And so we needed to dig it back up. And we hadn't really done such a great job at the beginning of treating them like individuals. And so that there was a hangover from that. In terms of how the philosophy of liberty works with the developmental stages of childhood, you know, as adults, we're always teaching kids things like don't hit. And that's, you know, that person has a property in their person. So you don't encroach upon them. And we're teaching them things like don't steal. Because that piece of property also belongs to them. So there are a lot of things that we teach children. We just don't call them what they are. But it boils down to property rights all the time, actually.
Right. Yeah. I'm always a little baffled when I've heard parents, or even in some of the educational environments that I've worked in, the phrase, you have to share. You have to share. Well, okay, then let's come up with a different word than share, you know, because that implies that there's like a voluntary thing going on. Maybe you have to surrender.
Right.
Would be better.
Right. I'm here with my greater physical presence. And if you don't do what I say, then you're toast.
Yeah, exactly.
That doesn't sound like sharing to me. That sounds like something. Yeah, there's got to be another name.
No, I mean, and I obviously it's nice to see people share voluntarily. Like, it's a nice thing.
Right. What people get scared about is they're afraid that if they don't teach their children to share or enforce sharing, that their children won't share. My experience is just the opposite. And that is that children who are allowed to keep their property, where property is valued, that child is going to be far more open-handed in the future. But they've got to go through normal developmental stages. And it's, you know, it doesn't have to be pathologized. Yes, there's going to be a time when your child is selfish. You don't have to push them out of that. They're going to be okay. Just let them outgrow it. They're good. They're going to share. They're going to be open-handed, particularly open-handed if property rights are sacrosanct.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. And I think when people are more secure in their own being, in their own selves, and they feel like there's a stable foundation that is self and self-ownership and property, well, when that security exists, that leads to empathy. you know, for other people. Like when people are terribly insecure and they feel like they have to wrap their arms around their things or their very being to protect themselves or their stuff. Yeah, not a lot of space in the mind for the needs of others. So I think that, developing that security in the individual builds empathy and understanding and compassion for other people. This is terribly distorted. I think most people's understanding of what libertarianism is, especially in an economic sense. Yeah, I think that is much better at fostering caring and sharing in other people, self-ownership.
Yeah, self-ownership, property rights, these things really, really matter. And one of the things that can get in your way as a parent of modeling these things or sort of following what it is that you actually believe is something really simple, and that is sleep deprivation. When you have young children in the house, you're going to get it wrong a lot because you're tired. And some people are not as affected by sleep deprivation, and some people are like sort of marginally, and then others are like me. And if you deprive me of you know, a reasonable amount of sleep, I'm going to be a complete nightmare. And sometimes parents think, well, I can't do this because I'm clearly an ogre. You're sleep deprived. Give it time. You're going to be okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's this attitude. I see it's never been, no one's ever explicitly said this to me as a parent, but this idea that, well, I can't be wrong. I'm in charge here, you know? So
yes, it's important to be wrong.
Yeah. 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 So they don't say that to them. They don't say that to their kids, obviously, like, oh, gosh, Jimmy, I've made a terrible mistake. But they don't say that to themselves, I think, enough either, from my experience, my observation.
Right. And children really need to see parents reconsidering, and they need to have that modeled for them. If you don't model, okay, I was wrong, I kind of lost it there, and I shouldn't do that, and I'm sorry, a sincere apology is something that a child needs to see an adult do. Because if you've never seen it, then you're not going to do it. And you're going to end up with a child, with an adult who can't do that, who can't say, okay, maybe I need to reconsider, or I need to think about this another way. Other ideas are okay and valid. So, you know, you need to model that. And it is difficult to do.
Mm. So we've established so far a fantastic foundation for home education here, but you know what happens next? Would you call yourself, you know, an unschooler? How would you describe the actual day-to-day educational environment as it exists now?
I would say we are unschoolers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's a lot of confusion about that term.
And yes.
I don't know where it comes from, and I'm not willing to try and chase it down. But there's sort of this general uneasiness about unschooling, that it might be abandonment of the child to their own devices. And that's just not so. At least in our house, that's not how it goes. We're in constant contact with our children, their needs, their capacities. We're always observing them. We're trying to figure out, okay, what is interesting to you? How can I put cool things in front of you? Where are your strengths? How are you learning? Where is your modality still dominantly here, or is it sort of shifting over here? And we take more of a Montessori approach to how we unschool our children, which means that we do a lot of observation, mm-hmm. a lot of thinking about what plane of development they're in, what are their needs and capacities. So all of that really comes heavily into play. Also, what are your natural gifts? We've got one son who's a musician and has been for a very long time. If very long can be applied to a 13-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
So he plays the organ, and he plays the piano, and he sings in two choirs, and sometimes he composes. So when we're saying we're unschooling, I mean, he's spending, you know, 2 hours a day at the piano and the organ, sometimes 3, sometimes 4 hours a day. And there, you know, there's a lot of time being spent at lessons and the time with music theory and listening. So in terms of unschooling, what that means is that we're following him, and he has expressed a really keen interest in music. And so that's what we do. We spend a lot of time on that. He travels with his choir. He's sung in a few different countries, and he goes by himself with his choir. So unschooling for us means that we follow the child. And people say, oh, but he's never going to learn calculus. Well, he might well learn calculus. He's already asked for things like German lessons and Latin. Mm-hmm. And these are things that he has asked for because he finds that they're going to be useful to him. They're not things that I've said, hey, why don't you do this? He's come and said, I think these are some of the things that I'd like to do. So that's what unschooling looks like with our older child.
There is something, though, that I think, as far as home education is concerned, that does require some instruction. And I've heard you talk about this before in a Mises interview, the trivium.
Right.
So you have incorporated this into that environment. I'd be interested in hearing how that happened.
Well, what happened, we started, actually, with the trivium with our older son. And it became apparent after a few years that this method was going to work for other children, but it wasn't necessarily working for him the way that we were implementing it. We were using the well-trained mind. Mm-hmm. And what I found was that although we had applied ourselves to it, there was a lot of strife in the household. And my husband would come home and he'd say, you've got to do something. You have got to do something. And so we kind of backed off. And I'm not sure how we implement the trivium, except to say that I understand those stages of development. You know, that 3 to 6 year old child, that 6 to 9 year old child, and that 9 to 12 year old child, those are developmental planes that Montessori spoke about very extensively. And we call them the Paul Pot and the Pert. And tell me the third one, because it's out of my head now.
Oh, it's out of mine too. But this is definitely, it's in The Lost Tools of Learning by Dorothy Sayers.
Yeah.
I'll put it in the show notes. But just so if people are unfamiliar, I do want to go back to The Well-Trained Mind because I've never read it, and I just want to get some more information about that. But the basic argument was that I believe, you know, in Sayers and Montessori, their arguments are a little different, but that this kind of learning, this kind of critical thinking development happens in stages.
Right.
So the idea is when you know, we ask this difficult question of, well, we have this sort of laissez-faire unschooling environment, but there's this very important kind of instruction that needs to happen. I think the thing that works in our favor is it's a natural process. It's what the human mind wants to do, so we're making it explicit. We're giving the process a label, right? Which
right.
is obviously the very important first step in the trivium. You identify, and being able to identify tools that we can use, tools that we naturally have, so they can be recalled and put to use later, is very helpful. So it's just kind of saying, hey, you know, here's what your mind tries to do, how it tries to make sense of the world, how it tries to solve problems, and these are the three steps.
Right. What I find is that, like, Montessori works with most children, mm-hmm. but there are children, and I have one of these in my house, that Montessori doesn't work for them. The stages of development, as described in detail by Montessori, did not apply to my second child.
Yeah.
So the trivium was not appropriate for him. The Montessori style of learning did not work for him and still does not work for him. So I have to follow the child. And what Montessori would tell me, I know this, she would say, follow the child. However it is that he learns, do that. And that's what we do with him. With our older child, fine arts is where he's at. He's music, and then more music. And also economics, which is interesting.
Yeah. It's a nice combo.
Yeah, it works really well.
Yeah, and it always makes me nervous when I'm reading something and it says, here's what you do, you know?
Right. Yes. Here's what you do. It doesn't, and what's more is it makes me nervous when people ask me, at what age should?
Yes.
Wow, this is an individual. This is a human being. This is, I don't know, at what age should your child wear a size 3 shoe? And if he's not wearing a size 3 shoe, are you going to put him into it anyway?
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense. I don't know at what age what your first grader should know. Good gracious. Start your fire with that book, but don't read it. That's not going to work. Because all children, they, there are gifts, you know, that they receive, but one child will receive this gift at this time, and the child standing next to it will receive it 6 years later, and they're both okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're individuals.
Yes, well said. Now, I have one more kind of unprepared question, but I was actually listening to this Mises interview that you did, and I would love to just enter this into our conversation. It's the topic of history. I was fascinated with your take, and I'll link to that Mises interview in the show notes for this podcast. You were talking about the way history was taught in public school, and I used to be a history teacher in a private school, essentially using the public school curriculum. I would just love to get a little snapshot of some of the historical discussions that have gone on in your home.
We talk economics first. We talk economics and political philosophy first. And everything that we look at in terms of history is going to have to pass through that screen. It's going to have to go through the lens of economics and the lens of the non-aggression principle and property rights. And was somebody violating someone else's property rights in history when they did this thing? Did the non-aggression principle come into play in this event in history? What was the that's the first question. What was the economic reason behind this action in history? Because there's always an economic reason. And some people say follow the money, but you know, that's one of the first questions that we ask. We ask, where was the money and how did it come into play here? You know, the pilgrims weren't showing up. You know, America isn't being settled for religious freedom. They want to find a way to India, and they want to get to India faster. They want to get spices. And this is motivated by commercial interest, as well it should be. But we need to look at that. It isn't because we're these noble people that came for religious freedom. What kind of silly mythology is this that we're telling our children?
Yeah.
But we do this, and we do this with a lot of history. And, you know, we don't talk about what kind of economic things happened right before we got into World War II. And, you know, well, let's see what Robert Higgs has to say about this over here at the Independent Institute. I bet he's got something to say about it.
Yeah, Robert Higgs was great for just his theories on the development of civilization and the state itself. He has this great story I heard him tell one time. I forget where, and I've looked for the audio. I've never found it again. It was on an iPod that I had 6 years ago, and that's not retrievable at this point. So it was, it might have been, I feel like it was at Foundation for Economic Education. He was giving a talk, and he talked about, and I used it in a show a couple of years ago, the comparative advantage of violence. Some people in early civilizations, you had people who were the hunters, the warriors.
Right.
And they said, well, we could just turn this inward and kind of be the guys in charge. And that's a super oversimplification of what he said. But yeah, I really like Robert Higgs. And I think, you know, one of the challenges with history is, I think one of the important realizations that people interested in history have to accept is you're never going to have a monopoly on exactly what happened. And all we really have is these lenses. And, you know, what you're talking about where you say, all right, well, the first question we're going to ask is, you know, about were property rights respected? Or that's going to be in the first line of questioning about a certain event. Well, that undoes the great man theory of history right there, you know, because all the heroes of at least the last couple hundred years were people, you know, perfectly happy using other people's basically stolen money to do quote-unquote great things or noble things.
Right.
But I realized that, because I cover history a lot on my show, that I have a lens that's filtered with this philosophy, obviously. So I'm going to be, you know, not in a way where it's straight out confirmation bias, where I'm only searching for things that confirm what I already believe. But obviously I want to tell stories that are entertaining to the audience that I've built, that fit the model of thought that I have. I mean, you know, if I was a communist, I certainly would be combing through history books with a, you know, completely different lens. And just acknowledging that, I think, is important. And, you know, recognizing that maybe the great man thing is important, but the trends and forces thing is important. The cultural thing is important. And, you know, if you can combine those, maybe you can get a fuller picture and also recognize the filter on the lens through which you see the past.
Right.
So that was an important lesson of Robert Higgs, because he's telling this fun, interesting story, but it's very clear that it's coming through his filter. But it's, you know, fantastically thought-provoking at the same time.
I think history is really difficult to get into before you understand property rights and economics and all of these things. I think that the place that we begin is with property rights, the non-aggression principle, and Austrian economics. And for my money, it has to be Austrian economics. And we begin teaching that early. Learn Liberty has a phenomenal set of videos, and our you know, favorites are Art Carden and Mike Munger and Ian Scoble. And we our boys love these economics videos, and they're great. You know, if my 7-year-old is running to see an economics video, it's really well done. Mm. And so that right there, because he understands just the most basic things about trade, history is going to make more sense to him. He's going to have sort of a more discerning, questioning process, because he understands economics, he understands trade, he gets all of that, and he's getting it from really entertaining videos, frankly.
Yeah, and if you're not doing it's if you're not incorporating that, you are like completely neglecting motivation.
Right.
It's like, you know, once upon a time, some bad stuff happened, but good thing there were people in charge and they were kind of like visionaries, and the problem was caused by, you know, either not enough government or too much freedom. But then, you know, brave visionaries stepped in and solved the problem.
Thank goodness we have those benevolent overlords. I am so thankful for them, because they are always getting us out of the scrape, aren't they?
For them,
they never do anything wrong.
It's interesting, because like one unquestionable hero in American history was FDR, Roosevelt. And, you know, I remember the first time I was exposed to something that I wouldn't be like a go-to source of information. It was Hitler's declaration of war against the United States. And just getting that different perspective and seeing, you know, and then obviously fact-checking what I read, because he wasn't the most reliable source of information in many ways, that there were tremendous economic motivations and all of these connections to Wall Street and central banking. And, you know, like if that is neglected from the story of history, yeah, you would just think it's like, you know, It's like some kind of kid's show where there's very clear line between good and bad. I mean, even calling it a kid's show is insulting to young people. I'm sorry. I shouldn't say that. It's just a very simplistic presentation. So, yeah, I think that's fantastic. And you mentioned Learn Liberty. Before we wrap up, do you want to just run down a few other resources that you would recommend?
Sure. Learn Liberty, like I said, is fantastic. And I've mentioned the Ludwig von Mises Institute a couple of times. The Mises Academy, but there are loads of videos over there too. YouTube has great videos as well. I really enjoy, and we do a lot of videos because both of our boys are very visual. So the Philosophy of Liberty has that great video on property. It has one on plunder. The George Ought to Help video series, those are terrific. Keynes' Hayek Rap is excellent. Also, we like the Politically Incorrect Guides. Those are terrific. Tom Woods has one. Bob Murphy has one. Kevin Good has one. I like all of those. We especially enjoy Richard Mabry's Uncle Eric series. Those are really fantastic. And also, Murray Rothbard is accessible to early adolescents as well. So, for example, my son and I read Education Free and Compulsory. And we also read What Has the Government Done to Our Money?
Yep.
And he's 13, and we're beginning with, the name has gone out of my head. I'll have to call you back with it so you can put it in the notes. But he's the godfather of Austrian economics. And Karl Menger, thank you. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
He's Karl Menger. And so he's beginning to read that too. It's excellent, excellent stuff. And in terms of parenting, there's a great book by Frances Kendall called Super Parents, Super Kids. And as with any parenting book, I don't agree with all of it, but I agree with most of it. And that's worth every penny you pay for. It's a great book.
Yeah, and we also mentioned The Well-Trained Mind. Who's that by, and what use have you gotten out of that?
I just went back to my bookshelf. That's Susan Wise Bauer. I'll tell you what, the Well-Trained Mind for me was useful in terms of history and literature. But in terms of what I keep around for reference purposes is a series from the Royal Fireworks Press, and it begins with Sentence Island, but I like the entire series in terms of language arts. It's lyrical, it's beautiful, it's not insulting to a child. And I think it took me a long, long time to find a grammar curriculum that I felt like, okay, if my child has questions about grammar, I have no problem putting this in front of him. And so that's the Michael Clay Thompson. That's a series of books that he wrote, and it begins with Sentence Island. And again, Royal Fireworks Press is excellent. And then for math, Edward Zaccaro has fantastic books, and we keep them for reference because what we find is that our children just sort of stumble upon these concepts. And they, the other day I asked my son, can I give you sort of a test on addition? And he said, I know addition. Why don't you do multiplication? I said, I haven't taught you multiplication. Have you taught yourself to multiply? And he said, yeah, I can do that. And he had taught himself to multiply because I'd left him alone. And he does the same thing with reading. I don't sit down with him and say, okay, now we're going to do phonics, because phonics didn't work with him. That's not the way he learned. My older son learned with phonics. It was fantastic. I thought I'd had it all figured out. And then my second child came along and steamrolled everything. It was quite the learning experience with him. I didn't expect that he would shift my paradigm as hard as he did, but he sure did.
Terrific. Well, Anna, thank you so much. That was certainly an information-dense 45 minutes, and I think my audience will really appreciate this discussion. How can they find you and check out what you're doing?
I'm at this is all lowercase, thelibertarianhomeschooler.com, and that's the blog. But they can also find me at my Facebook page, which is The Libertarian Homeschooler. And so I'm really glad that we got this chance to talk. This has been so enjoyable.
Yeah, it's been great. We should do it again. If you have anything that becomes a big topic of discussion, my website is schoolsucksproject.com. We have a forum. We have groups there. Every group has a dedicated forum for different topics. So, I'll certainly point folks to your work and your blog. And thank you so much.
Well, likewise. And I'll enjoy talking with you again.
What would you do if you had 3 or 4 hours to kill in Worthington, Ohio? That's an easy question. First up today, we have J.H., who is in Lowell, Massachusetts. Well, Lowell was the first planned industrial city in the United States. That started happening around the 1820s. By the time of the Civil War, it was pretty much the industrial center of the U.S. How about that? Now, I used to live in this area back in the day. If you're ever down there, now there's a lot of attractions. It's a very historic place, but I highly recommend you go and eat at Bonkers Funhouse Pizza, because it's, is the food good there? I've only been there a couple of times. It wasn't memorable, but it was sure fun to say, I'm going to Bonkers Funhouse Pizza. Crap. No. Bonkers Funhouse was in a different town. It was on Lowell Street, but it was in some other town. Damn. Well, okay, how about this? Speaking of one of our themes on the show, politicians jumping in front of parades, I remember the first time I ever paid attention to a presidential election was 1988, and the Massachusetts governor, a guy named Michael Dukakis, was running for president against the vice president, George H.W. Bush. I was only 10 at the time, and I remember what a tough decision it was going to be for the voters, you know, two wonderful and charismatic men. And one of the themes of the campaign was economic growth in Massachusetts. So there was something that was referred to when I was a little fella called the Massachusetts Miracle. And there were a lot of these mill towns in Massachusetts that were hit pretty hard when the mills closed, obviously, economically, they were hit pretty hard. But in the 1980s, there's all this awesome unoccupied real estate in the city of Lowell. These tech companies move in. Obviously, there's an upsurge in the economy in Lowell and other cities. And Michael Dukakis tried to take credit for that. Lowell, Mass. Next up, we have Todd S., who is in Spokane, Washington, birthplace of Father's Day, 1910, the first celebration. And a happy day it was for all those Spokane fathers. Neat. And finally today, Todd S., from Wilmington, North Carolina. This is where Cape Fear is. You know, the two movies. One was like a Scorsese movie with Nick Nolte and Robert De Niro. And then there was a Robert Mitchum and Gregory Peck version in the 60s. This is where it is. Giovanni Di Verrazzano, who the bridge is named after up in New York, he was the first European, that we know of anyway, to land in this region. And he said, yeah, it's really nice. So where does this name Cape Fear come from? Well, the water is apparently a little bit treacherous at times. And there's a Cape Fear River that runs right through Wilmington. If you're ever there, check out the old Baldy Lighthouse. It's the oldest in the state. And you know what? Let's actually do one more. We have Jess M., who lives, I would say, right smack dab in the center of Ohio almost, in the town of Worthington. And many of you are probably asking, Brett, what would you do if you had 3 or 4 hours to kill in Worthington, Ohio? That's an easy question. I would go to the Ohio Railway Museum. It's one of the oldest in the country. It's been open since 1948. That's when they started acquiring cars from all these old railways. Obviously, you know, you got a lot of railways running through there. The Columbus, the Delaware, the Marion. You know, all these railroads that date back to the early 20th century. Well, you know, full disclosure, I've never been there. So let's talk to somebody who has. We go to Yelp for that. Worth the $6 for a quick train ride and to wander around the old trains. I could not agree more. This place sounds and looks, from the pictures that I'm seeing, very cool. It looks like they've got about 15 cars at this location, and it's actually on the tracks of an old train station, which is very neat. Do you like trains? Why not?
New subscriber geography trivia. You just say a person's name and they tell a fact about where they live.